The Book Club at 91.7. I'm Mark Purcell. Bourbon Curious, a simple tasting guide for the savvy drinker by Fred Minnick, is available in bookstores now. It is a fantastic guide to that brown liquid of love that is, that's produced a lot in Kentucky, but also around the world. You can learn a lot from Bourbon Curious. And here to share some of what he knows in the studio with me is Fred Minnick. Fred, welcome to the Book Club at 91.7.
Thanks for having me.
I'll begin at the beginning when you basically need to define bourbon, because everybody, we won't get into whether there's an E in whiskey or not an E in whiskey, which I know is another debate that goes on. But what exactly is bourbon? Because you make it clear in Bourbon Curious in the introduction that that's a little hard to nail down.
Yeah, well, bourbon's so popular now that, you know, people walk into a liquor store and they just say they want bourbon. And what's being lost in a lot of this enthusiasm are the basic facts. And bourbon is a whiskey. So whiskey is a categorical term. Scotch is a whiskey. Canadian whiskey is a whiskey. Irish whiskey is a whiskey. And bourbon is a whiskey. Whiskey essentially means distilled grain aged in wood. So it's distilled beer that's been aged. And the bourbon business has done such a great job of branding itself as bourbon and not as a whiskey. And then Kentucky distillers have done a great job of branding Kentucky bourbon that all this marketing effort has kind of impacted what people know and how they think of bourbon. And so in the very beginning, I try to present it as simple as I can about what bourbon is. And I define it. I give the definition, the regulated terms of bourbon, because this is a highly regulated category. There are actual definitions, and then I kind of weave in some histories and what have you. And so that's a very simple, basic principle of what bourbon is has somewhat been lost and a lot of the liquor stores you go to today.
And one, you talk about a blowhard in a bar in the beginning, talking mm-hmm. about being what whiskey is and what whiskey yeah. isn't, or what bourbon is and what bourbon isn't. And one of the things I know many people will find disappointing about around here is bourbon doesn't have to come from Kentucky.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, bourbon is actually made all over the United States right now. In the 1964 declaration from Congress that declared bourbon to be a unique product of the United States basically just gave it geographical protection from other countries. And in fact, you know, Mexico was making bourbon prior to that declaration. So if anyone has a free trade agreement with us, they just can't make, you know, they have to follow our laws of bourbon, which has to be made in the United States. And it always does upset people if they're passionate about Kentucky bourbon. It always upsets them about the fact it doesn't have to be made in Kentucky. And it's always like older ladies. Older ladies tend to be very passionate and will stick a finger in my chest occasionally and say, no, it has to be made in Kentucky. And even the Kentucky governor, Steve Beshear, goes around and says that 95% of the country's bourbon comes from Kentucky, and he says the rest of it's counterfeit. So, I mean, they have a little fun with it, but they take it very seriously in Kentucky.
Well, there's something else you mentioned as well that I want to quote the line because it's such a great line that most of what's on the label of a bottle of bourbon.
Well, this is the radio.
It's the most BS per square inch, yeah. Even better than a political ad, because it's so much of its marketing is what you're
saying. Yeah, I mean, bourbon is, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful product. It's great tasting, but there's a lot of BS involved. And, you know, there's only a couple things that you can really trust on there, and that's the proof amount of the proof, you know, the age, if there's an age statement on there. And if you see straight bourbon on there, it's kind of a indication of quality. There's a few other things. But, like, if you read the back of some of the labels, and this is going back into the 1800s,
yes.
You know, it's saying, like, your grandpappy brought it back, brought a yeast from, you know, the great migration from England or something like that. I mean, they have a lot of fanciful stories that they put on there. And you know what? That's spirits across the board, you know, mm-hmm. whereas like with wine, you know, they tend to market a little bit more of like how the processes and how it's made. Even the terms like small batch and single barrel, those are not regulated terms for bourbon. those are fanciful terminology. That's fanciful terminology. And while there's an industry practice of what small batching is, someone could very well dump 5,000 barrels of bourbon into a bottling and call it small batch, and that would be completely within the confines of the law.
Bourbon Curious, a simple tasting guide for the savvy drinker by Fred Minnick, available in bookstores now. You can learn more about it at WVXU.org. Fred will be at Books by the Banks, the Cincinnati USA Book Festival, coming up on October 17th. Details about that festival and Fred's work at our website, WVXU.org. And you mentioned there's few things that you can trust. Well, let's talk about age, because that there is a lot of conversation when it comes to bourbon about age.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to, I think, if I recall from Bourbon Curious correctly, at least 2 years in that barrel.
Well, that's for straight bourbon.
For straight bourbon, that's
if,
right.
If there's no, if you don't see straight on the label, then there's no age requirement. But age is a hotly debated topic amongst the people who, you know, follow bourbon and drink it. And the reason why is because we're starting to see a reduction in age statements. Like Jim Beam Black used to be, it had a stated age of 8 years old. It's no longer there. The stated age is gone. Very Old Barton used to have a stated age of 6 years old. That is gone. So we're starting to see these age statements drop. And so you're hearing people say, no, don't take away our age statements. We need that. You know, because as consumers, we love tasting and comparing and contrasting. And if we just have a bottle and a brand, we don't know a whole lot about what we're comparing and contrasting to. And that's what I do in Bourbon Curious a lot, is I try to give as much information as I possibly can so consumers can compare and contrast brands. But when it comes to, if you see the age, let's say it's 12 years old, now they can put 20-year-old whiskey in that mingling, but they cannot call it 20-year-old whiskey if there's a single barrel of 12-year-old whiskey. It has to be the age of the youngest barrel in the batch. If the brand is under 4 years old, they are supposed to tell you what the age is if it's under 4 years old. That's one where a lot of brands are not in government compliance. I could, you know, there's probably a dozen to 20 that are under 4 years old, and they don't give you the exact age of the whiskey. So it is a hotly debated topic, and some people think it matters, some people it doesn't. For me, the sweet spot of aged bourbon is usually between 12 and like 17 years. I have had some really exceptional 20-year-old bourbons and 23-year-old bourbons, but the majority of them tend to be over-oaked and over, a little too woody. And the reason why, and like Scotch has done a great job of promoting its age, but Scotch is being aged in used cooperage. So bourbon's going into a new barrel every single time. That's part of the regulation. And that's also taking out, they're also getting the front end of all those tannins and wood sugars from the barrel, whereas the Scotch guys are getting them on the back end. Like in order for them to get the same color and extraction from the barrel, they have to keep it in there a lot longer. And, you know, we're getting a lot more of the upfront wood sugars, and they're getting it more on the back end. So they need to age in Scotland, and the weather's different there. So age is, it's debated, and, you know, there's a sweet spot for every brand. Maker's Mark thinks it's between, you know, 6 and 7 years old. So everyone's different.
Well, talk about the resurgence of bourbon. I see it kind of following along with craft beer, because there is a lot of more artisanal distillery going on right now. But and there is a lot of focus swinging back to bourbon. Is this more of the marketing, Fred, or why
actually,
this renewed attention?
It's passion, and I think when we look at why bourbon's made its comeback, we have to analyze why it went away. Coming out of Prohibition, there was so much enthusiasm for bourbon. There was all kinds of money coming in, new distilleries popping up, families resurrecting their brands and their family recipes. And that momentum carried until World War II. When World War II hit, the government basically said the grains have to go toward the war effort, and distilleries, the only way that they could, you know, remain in business was if they started making industrial alcohol for the World War II effort. And so what happened was a lot of brands could not survive that. You know, so they're like, all right, we're done. They would sell to a large conglomerate called Schindler, or there were, you know, they would just fold and move on to something else. And so World War II was a big impact. It was a big equalizer for the bourbon distilleries. Then the 1950s hit. They're starting to regain focus, but that next generation, the 1960s, someone went on, you know, the big screen and said he wanted a martini shaken and not stirred. In 1952, vodka represented 1% of the total sales of spirits. In the 1960s, it started, you know, Smirnoff and a lot of these brands started just skyrocketing. And so by this time, a lot of these companies who owned bourbon brands also were seeing the market, and they started divesting in bourbon and investing more into vodka and other spirits. And so the enthusiasm from the 1960s generation of drinkers was that I didn't want to drink the same thing as my parents did.
Right.
And so they started drinking more vodkas, and that carried over into the 1970s, a time when you had major distilleries like Stitzel Weller closing, Old Taylor closing, later on would be Old Crow. I mean, you would have all of these big time names that essentially folded because the market would not support them. But the passion in Kentucky never went away. The distillery community was largely made up of a lot of big families, and the talent continued. And so the 1980s, when the bourbon industry was left for dead, you basically had Maker's Mark skyrocketing up, you know, like crazy. It would get a major report in it in the Wall Street Journal. That created enthusiasm, and that brand influenced the way George T. Stagg Distillery came out with Blanton's. Elmer T. Lee came out. That was the very first commercially available single barrel in the early to mid 1980s. Jim Beam came out with the Booker No. Came out with the small batching technique in the 1980s as well. So you had these super premium bourbons, like attention really focused on the detail of what went inside to each bottle, you know, making it the best it could possibly be. And they started giving it marketing support. And then the 1990s saw brands like Jefferson's, Michter's, Woodford Reserve, all these new brands started coming out, and Bullet Bourbon. And you had this, you know, each one of these brands had their own level of marketing dollars and their own effort to bring bourbon back. So and then the internet is born. And as soon as the internet is born, a guy in Alaska was arguing with a guy in Hawaii about what his favorite bourbon was.
Right.
And so the 2000s have been this organic growth, largely from the consumers. And now we have bourbon being made all over the United States. And, you know, just down the road here in Cincinnati, in Cincinnati area, you have the New Rift Distillery, which to me is one of the most promising new distilleries in the country.
Hmm. Well, we only have a moment or two left, Fred, but I wanted, you know, as you mentioned earlier, you walk in, you see a wall of bourbon, you know, what to choose from. We've already talked about how you can't believe everything you say on the label.
Yeah.
What do you suggest for someone who wants to be savvy when it comes to tasting bourbon?
Well, if you have, let's say you have $40, there is bang for your buck. And what you want to look for is color. You know, color is if you can hold up the bottle against the light, that is an indication of its age, its proof level, and oftentimes its robust flavors. So that's color is very important to me, because that's a representation of the brand's, you know, the whiskey's time in the barrel. If you have one shot and that's what you're basing it on, go inside, see if you can assess them with the darker the color. And if you have $25, I'm gonna tell you to go with either Four Roses Small Batch. If you're here in town, get OKI from New Riff, you know, Maker's Mark, Blanton's, even Woodford Reserve. Those are all in that price range you can afford.
And I love how you say in Bourbon Curious in the beginning, go out and taste it. Don't believe the marketing. Go out and taste
it.
That's the best way.
And really, you've got some great bourbon bars here. You have Old Kentucky Bourbon Bar by, you know, Molly Wellman. And that's the best place to taste is a bar. And talk to the bartenders, you know, because those are the most knowledgeable people, you know, that you'll have interacting time with. And if you have some, if you have a friend who's willing to go out and buy the stuff, you know, see if you can go over to his house and drink his whiskey.
good advice. I like that, Fred. Well, thanks for being here this morning.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Fred Minnick. His book is Bourbon Curious, a simple tasting guide for the savvy drinker. It's part history, part guide, and a lot of great advice. You can learn more about it at our website, wvxu.org. And Fred will be at Books by the Banks, the Cincinnati USA Book Festival, October 17th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., the Duke Energy Convention Center. More about Bourbon Curious and about the festival at wvxu.org. This is The Book Club at 91.7. You've been listening to The Book Club at 91.7. Technical director for the show is Rick Andres. Producer is Kevin Reynolds. Assistant producer is Catherine Cunningham. Web guru is Jim Nolan. And I'm Mark Purcell. Next weekend on The Book Club at 91.7, the preview of Books by the Banks. The Cincinnati USA Book Festival continues with a look at nonfiction authors who will be in attendance and a conversation with mystery writer David Bell about his latest thriller, Somebody I Used to Know. David will be at Books by the Banks. Plus Big Magic with Eat, Pray, Love author Elizabeth Gilbert and Lauren Groff discussing her novel Fates and Furies, the NPR Book Club pick. That's all next Saturday morning. Stay tuned for Weekend Edition next on 91.7 WVXU. Have a great Saturday.